Discussing the idea of controllable coupling of two flux qubits, starting with the theory and then the experiment, and then I will conclude. And this is work that's been going on in my group in Berkeley for the last 2 or 3 years, and very much supported theoretically by Frank and also by Birgitta Whaley and her postdoc, Zhang. So let me quickly remind everyone of the two ingredients of the flux qubit, namely Josephson tunneling. And here we're concerned with two superconductors that are separated by an insulating barrier. And Josephson taught us that Cooper pairs were able to tunnel coherently from one superconductor to the other through this tunnel barrier. And this coherent tunneling, of course, gives us a supercurrent. If one measures the current voltage characteristic, one finds something like this, that as you increase the current from zero, initially there's no voltage, and then there is an abrupt switching to a finite voltage regime, and then as you decrease the current again, eventually you go back to the zero voltage state. And this Josephson tunneling is involved both in the qubit itself and also in the readout scheme. The second idea is flux quantization. And the idea there is that if you were to cool a superconducting loop in a magnetic field and then turn off the magnetic field, the flux that remains is supported by a circulating supercurrent and is quantized in units of the flux quantum phi0, which is h over 2e. And so these two ideas come into both the qubits and into the squid, which is the readout mechanism. The three-junction qubit was introduced to us by Hans Muhe and co-workers. And in brief, we have a loop of superconductor that is interrupted by three Josephson tunnel junctions, one of them with a smaller critical current than the other two. If we bias the qubit at the degeneracy point, where the applied flux is one half of a flux quantum, then one can have two situations, one of which has an anti-clockwise current producing a flux up, and a clockwise current which produces a flux pointing down. And these, of course, will be degenerate in energy. If we denote these two states by 0 and 1, then we will have a superposition of states which can be symmetric or antisymmetric. Now, we can describe the flux qubit in terms of a two-well potential, as I've indicated here. And again, if one is at the degeneracy point with half a flux quantum applied to the qubit, then the two wells are symmetric. And there are two possible eigenstates, a symmetric one, the red one, and a blue one, which is antisymmetric. And of course, this is exactly analogous to what one finds with the ammonium molecule. The energy splitting between these two states we call delta. If we now apply a flux that is, say, greater than half a flux quantum, what we find is that we now have a non-symmetric pair of wells. And again, we will have two possible quantum states, but now their splitting will be increased to a value mu. We're going to call the energy epsilon, which represents the asymmetry in the two wells, as the quantity 2iq, which is the circulating current, the applied flux minus phi0 over 2. And one can then show that this splitting nu is of the form of the square root of delta squared plus epsilon squared, as I've indicated here. So here is delta, this is the splitting at the degeneracy point, and nu is the splitting as you go away from the degeneracy point. And so one of the goals is to determine the validity of this model in a real experiment. Well, the readout system consists of a DC squid. And in essence, this consists now of two junctions coupled on a superconducting loop. And we can bias this with a current. And we could apply a magnetic flux, which I called phi sub s. And in general, something we'll come back to, this will induce a circulating current J around the loop. So what happens now is that, again, if we imagine increasing the bias current, there will be a switching point to the non-zero voltage regime. But now the value at which this current, the value of the current when it switches depends on the applied flux. And so here we're plotting the switching current versus the flux applied to the squid. And it has a maximum for zero flux. And this oscillation is now periodic in one flux quantum. And so if you imagine that the squid is operated on a region like this, where there's a strong variation of the critical current with applied flux, and you can see that this is going to be very sensitive to the value of the applied flux. And by determining the switching current, we can determine the flux in the squid. So let me now turn to the configuration of the experiment. What I've shown here is the configuration for the two-qubit experiment. But what I want to do first is discuss the properties briefly of a single qubit, and then we'll move on to the coupled qubits. So the two qubits shown as these rectangles, here's qubit A and here's qubit B, and they are typically something like 90 microns long and maybe 20 microns wide. There are three tunnel junctions here, which are shown in an exploded view here. The one, two, three junctions. And these are made using E-beam lithography and evaporated aluminium films. And between the first and second evaporation, we admit a controlled amount of oxygen to the vacuum system, and this grows the oxide layer. The two qubits are surrounded by this bigger rectangle, and this is the DC squid. And there are two junctions in here, one of them here and one of them here. And for technical reasons, these are made in a sort of longitudinal rather than a cross geometry. But the basic way that they're made is the same. And in fact, these are all made in a single process. Now, you also notice that there are these extra lines here called flux lines. And if we now pass a static current through these two loops, which are coupled in series, then obviously we couple magnetic flux to both the qubit A and also to the squid, and somewhat to qubit B. And there's a second pair of flux lines down here, which we can also use to couple flux to the squid and also predominantly to the lower qubit. And these will actually play quite an important role in the experiments I'm going to talk about, because this allows us to address independently the flux in either of the qubits by applying appropriate currents to the flux line. And that's a little bit different from what people have done in the past. I might also point out that the inductances of these devices are typically a couple of hundred picohenries, and these are about two orders of magnitude bigger than people have used in the past. And one of the reasons for that is to get good coupling between the two qubits, and also good coupling to the flux lines without having to use very large currents. So this is the basic kind of device that all of the subsequent measurements will be about. Well, how do we read out the squid? What we do is to measure the critical current by using a pulse technique. And so here's a pulse as a function of time. And what you see is that we suddenly turn on this pulse. We keep it on for a short time, typically 5 nanoseconds. We turn it down to a plateau. And eventually, a microsecond later, we turn it off. So when we apply this plateau, either the squid switches out to the finite voltage regime, or it stays in the zero voltage regime. And there's a certain probability of either of that happening, of those events happening. Now, if the squid switches, when we return the current to this intermediate plateau value, what happens is that the squid sits at this point here and remains in the finite voltage regime. And the reason to do that is it gives us a relatively low slow speed readout. And there's a practical reason for this. You want to minimize the bandwidth through which noise gets fed back into the readout system. And so there's a reason for making this a slow response. And so if this voltage appears, then we have a threshold detector. And this then tells the computer that the squid switched. So what we do is we pulse this bias current and detect the switching events. And we typically repeat this somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times. to determine the switching probability, and then we increment the current and we repeat this. And so typical experiments might involve anywhere between 1 million and 100 million measurements. So this plot here now indicates the probability of the squid switching as a function of the pulse current for two different situations. In the case of the red curve, we're at a current, we're at a flux below the degeneracy point, where the flux bit, flux qubit is specifically in one state. If we now change the flux to a little bit above the threshold, the degeneracy point, the qubit is definitely in the other state. And so this shows the change in the switching probability as we increment the pulse current. And you can see, for example, on the red curve, as you progressively increase the height of this pulse, it's more and more likely that the squid will switch. And if you're above the degeneracy point, then you get the blue curve. And you see there's a fair amount of daylight between them so that you can distinguish reasonably well whether you're in the upstate or the downstate. And so what we do in the end is determine the switching current that gives us a 50% switching probability. So all the measurements are made with this kind of scheme. So in order to measure the properties of the qubit, we need to do spectroscopy, and this is how we do that. First of all, if you notice the black line drawn through this curve, this is a curve that represents the qubit state, either 0 or 1, as a function of the flux in the qubit. Here's the degeneracy point, and you have a 50-50% chance of being in the 0 or the 1 state. If you go down to a slightly lower flux, you're certain to be in the 1 state, and a slightly higher value, you're certain to be in the 0 state. And what we then do is to apply a burst of microwaves before we do the measurement, and these microwaves introduce peaks in this curve. This is shown with three different microwave frequencies, and you can see, for example, here is a nice dip, and here's a peak in the qubit state corresponding to a particular microwave frequency. So obviously what we do now is to measure these peaks as a function of the qubit flux and of the microwave frequencies. And this will give us the spectroscopy. So here is the microwave spectroscopy of qubit A. And so what we're looking now is at the frequency of the microwaves in gigahertz. And this runs from somewhere below 9 gigahertz up to about 13, versus the flux that we've applied using the flux lines. And the dashed line in here is a fit to this formula I wrote down before, nu is equal to delta squared plus epsilon squared to the power 1/2. And you see the data, which are plotted in blue, changing color to red as we go from peaks to dips, are a very good fit to that formula. In this particular case, the splitting at the degeneracy point is about 8.872 gigahertz. We can also measure quite accurately the value of the qubit current, because you'll notice that that is given by the derivative of d epsilon by the applied flux. And so we also know rather accurately the value of the qubit current. I might also make the point that in our design, the whole experiment is surrounded by a superconducting shield. And the idea is to stabilize it against external variations in flux. And the stability of this is really quite good, that over a period of a month, the change in the flux was less than 10 to the minus 4 of a flux quantum. And despite the fact that we probably transferred liquid helium something like 7 or 8 times over that period of time, but because the candles remain superconducting, the flux is very stable. So I think this also indicates that one does have a system that you can run for very long periods of time. In fact, we've run this qubit for over a year to get some of the data I'm going to be showing. So that's the end of this sort of introduction to the single qubit, and now I want to talk about how one might couple two such qubits. And I'm sure I don't need to explain this, but the ability to switch the coupling of two qubits on and off is actually very useful for quantum computing algorithms. And for example, if you start with the qubits decoupled from each other, you can prepare their quantum state independently. And then you couple the qubits together and you allow the entanglement to take place. And then you uncouple them again and you can separately read out the states of the qubits. And so this is a story of a scenario by which you can actually implement this, which turns out to be very simple to do from an experimental point of view. And as we'll see, it doesn't involve really introducing any more components or any more control lines to the experiment. So let me first of all explain briefly what the idea is, and then we'll see in a little more detail how we do this. So if we now go back to considering these two qubits, A and B, we know that they have an interaction of the form sigma z, sigma c, and the interaction actually comes about through two contributions. And the first one is fairly obvious, that there is a mutual inductance, MQQ, between the two qubits, and that interaction is of the form of the mutual inductance times the product of these two qubit currents. And that, of course, is a fixed quantity. It's fixed by the geometry and by the properties of the qubits. But what may not be quite so obvious, but is central to this, is the fact that the qubits are also coupled by the squid. And you can see that immediately, that if the flux in qubit A were to change, then there will be a flux induced in the squid. This would give rise to a circulating current. And that current would then introduce a flux into qubit B. It turns out, and this is the crucial point, that the strength of that coupling depends on the bias current of the squid and the flux in the squid. And by controlling those, you can control the interaction between the two squids. So that's the basic idea of this. And now let me elaborate a little bit on how one actually does that. Now, I mentioned before that there is, in general, a circulating current that goes around the squid when you apply a flux. And let's just look at this a little bit more in detail. So this is the variation of this circulating current versus the applied flux. And first of all, one might do that for zero bias current in the squid. And what you see is that as you start to increase the flux, then this current builds up. And that's, of course, just the property of flux quantization. But as you go to higher and higher values of the flux, what you see is that this starts to roll off. And the reason is that the Josephson junctions actually have a kinetic inductance, which is nonlinear, and it increases as you increase the current. And so that means that the given change in the flux tends to give rise to a smaller and smaller change in the current. It gets more interesting, however, if you now imagine that you apply a bias current, that's IB, that flows through the squid. All of this is still in the zero voltage regime. And what you see is that these curves start to flatten out more and more. But what's even more interesting is you see that the differential value of this inductance changes. We have a positive inductance here that becomes a negative over here. And that's the secret of this device. So let's define an inverse inductance, which is dj by d phi s. And imagine now that we keep the flux in the squid constant, but we increase the bias current. What will happen to 1 over this inductance is the following. That initially it's positive, that's the value down here. Excuse me, that was wrong. This is the value of, say, the blue curve. But as you now progressively increase the bias current, what you see is that this dynamic inductance goes through zero and changes sign. So the fact that it changes sign enables you to control the coupling of the qubit. Oops. It's better. So if you work this out, what you find is that the net coupling energy between these two qubits actually has two contributions. And the first one that I've written down here is the controllable part. You can see it's the product of the mutual inductance of one qubit to the squared and of the other qubit to the squared, divided by this kinetic inductance that I just described, minus the direct mutual inductance MQQ. And so the first part of this, which I've called K sub S for squared, is controllable, and the second part is fixed. That's K zero. So if you now put in some numbers, this is a typical result for some typical parameters. Let's pick some parameters, and these will give rise to the static coupling energy that is, sorry, too many buttons on this thing. This gives rise to a static coupling energy, which turns out to be minus 0.16 gigahertz. Now, in addition, with no bias current in the squid, we find that the coupling energy is minus 0.14 gigahertz, and that is shown here. This is the total coupling energy for zero bias current in the squid. But if we now start to increase the bias current, what you see is that we progressively decrease the magnitude of the coupling along this curve here, and there's a particular value of bias current where the, I'm sorry, meant for smaller fingers than mine. There's a particular value of the bias current at which the coupling energy via the squid exactly couples the direct energy, and that's the point here. So you've turned off the two qubits. And subsequently, you will actually reverse the sign of the interaction. So that's the basic idea, and this is the experiment now that we want to test. So this now turns to the experiment. Let me just make a comment about the quantum mechanics of two coupled qubits with this sigma C interaction. That the basis states are of the following kind. You have a symmetric triplet where, say, one says spin up and zero is spin down. So the symmetric triplet has 1, 1 or 0, 0, and then the symmetric combination 0, 1 plus 1, 0. And of course, the antisymmetric singlet state is where you have 0, 1 minus 1, 0. And so these are the basis states. And as was shown by Frank a few years ago, the resultant eigenstates for the coupled qubits are the ground state, and then you have 1, 2, 3 excited states. And so we're going to be concerned now with the transitions between the ground state and the first two excited states. So before, we looked at the microwave spectroscopy of a single qubit, and now we're going to look at the two qubits, and the spectroscopy is shown here for both of them. And on this scale, it looks as though these curves cross, but we'll come back to that. And what you see is that the actual splittings for the two degeneracy points are remarkably close together. They're within about 1%. And that's something I believe we will never, ever do again. I think that we were extraordinarily lucky to get two qubits that were so well matched. And I might also make the point that in order to get two spectra that look like this, we took advantage of the fact that we had these two independent flux lines. And so what it means is that you can apply a flux to one qubit and the opposite sign flux to the other qubit in such a way that the net flux in the squid remains fixed. And this is a very important point, because remember that the dynamic inductance of the squid depends on the flux. So it's very important that you can keep that constant when you're making a curve like this. And so these curves were indeed measured at a constant squid flux, that is to say, at a constant qubit-qubit coupling. Now, let's now focus on what happens in this region where these two spectra appear to intersect, and of course they don't. What you get is an anti-crossing. And so the lower curve is the state 1, and the upper is the state 2. These two spectra intersect at about 11.25 gigahertz. And once again, these spectra are measured at a constant squid flux and a constant cubic-cubic coupling strength. And in this particular case, there's no bias current in the squid. And the coupling strength at this point here, or the splitting, is about 123 megahertz. So these two spectra represent transitions from the ground state to the state one, and then to the state two. Now, if you look a little more carefully at the data, what you see is that there are a lot of data points along this minimum here, but none along this maximum here. And that actually is a reflection of the symmetry of these states. And so let's look at briefly at how one forms these various states. Here is the ground state, which is a triplet state. And the four different colors represent, the blue is the up-up, the green is the symmetric state, and the red is the down-down, and the orange color is the antisymmetric state. And what you see is that there is absolutely no antisymmetric state for the ground state at the degeneracy point, which is here. It's a purely symmetric state. If you go to the singlet state, however, the state one, what we find is that at the degeneracy point, we have a purely antisymmetric state. That's the point here. And all the symmetric components have gone to zero. And finally, if you go to the state two, this is a symmetric state. And the antisymmetric part plummets to zero right at this degeneracy point. By the way, these degeneracy points are not quite at zero. And that's because of the slight asymmetries between the two qubits. And so what you see now is that we're making transitions between a symmetric state and an antisymmetric state in this case, and between two symmetric states in the other case. And so that explains why you have lots of data here, because you were making transitions from the symmetric ground state to the symmetric triplet state. But you have no transitions here. So, in fact, in principle, one should be able to measure the peak heights of the of these two spectra and compare them with the matrix elements of the transitions. And the matrix elements are of the form sigma ZA plus sigma CB. And these we plotted on the right-hand side of this plot here. This is the square of the matrix element. That's the solid line. And the points here with the error bars on are the measured peak heights in this region here. And what you see is that qualitatively, this follows the same trend. But obviously, quantitatively, this doesn't agree very well. And it raises a point that I think Frank and I need to discuss more. But when you do the calculation using a simple quantum mechanics and transitions between two levels, then you're assuming that you have transitions between states that relax, whereas we have states that predominantly decohere. And it's not entirely clear to me that these would give exactly the same form of the matrix element. But anyway, it's interesting to see that there's a clear distinction quantitatively between these two curves. Well, finally, let's control the coupling of these qubits. And the way we do that is the following. Remember that we change the coupling by changing the bias current in the squid. And so what we do is to turn on this pulse, which is too small to cause the squid to switch, so it remains in the zero voltage regime. And subsequently, we turn on our microwaves to do the spectroscopy. We turn those off, and then we apply the readout pulse. And so what you hope is that because of this pulse here, you will decrease the splitting of the two spectra. And indeed, that's what you see. And so here, once again, are the spectra with zero bias current in the squid. This is actually a slightly different value because we did these measurements at a slightly different frequency. If we now increase the bias current, we see that we decrease the splitting. We increase the bias current some more, the splitting gets smaller still. And if you then do a whole series of measurements like that, what you find is a plot that looks like this. So the squares are the measured data. These are the splitting as a function of the bias current. And what you see that the splitting goes down to zero, and as we increase this bias current some more, then we find that the splitting increases again, and it must therefore change sign. Now, the solid red curve here is our calculated value of the splitting with no fitted parameters. And there are actually a lot of parameters that go into this problem. There are all the inductances, the mutual inductances, the bias current, the critical current, and so on. What we did in the end was decide that we understood the currents least well, and we fitted the curves with appropriate values of the critical current and bias current, and you get this dashed line here, and you can see that it really follows the data very well. So, although we had to do a certain amount of fitting, we believe that we have a pretty good handle on the behavior of these two qubits. I'll just very briefly mention that some time ago, Frank and others of us went through a scenario where we could actually do a CNOT gate using this controllable coupling. And the basic idea is that you start by having the qubits decoupled, and then you can do the appropriate single qubit rotations. You turn the two qubits on, so you can do the manipulation, and then you turn off the two qubits again, and then you can do rotations and you can do readout. And so this is actually a very plausible scenario, and I think the total time for this particular CNOT gate was about 29 nanoseconds. So it's something that you could hope to build. Well, let me summarize this part of the talk. So what I've shown is that the spectroscopy of these coupled qubits shows the expected splitting of the first and second excited states. I haven't got into it, but in fact, we've done quite a lot of time domain work on the splitting also, and we can show things like Rabi oscillations and flux echoes. The peak heights measured from the transitions from the 0 to 1 state and the 0 to 2 states agree qualitatively with the square of the calculated matrix elements, but with some perhaps interesting differences. We showed that we could reduce the coupling to zero and even reverse the sign by applying a bias current in the squid. And I'd like to emphasize the following point, that this is the only additional manipulation that you have to do, that you don't need extra control lines. All you have to do is to change the magnitude of the bias current that you would subsequently use to read out the squid. So it's a very simple and very scalable architecture from that point of view. And I made the point also that these independent flux lines are very important in this. You have to be able to control the fluxes in these two qubits separately, but you don't switch the fluxes, you keep them constant. And finally, this is a scheme in which you could actually implement a CNOT gate, and that would provide a useful building block for scalable universal logic. So all of this sounds very nice, and you can say, well, why aren't you making this? And so that brings me to the second half of the talk. And let's, in the second half, discuss somewhat what I think are the crucial issues. Are the crucial issues, in fact, one crucial issue in scaling up flux qubits and maybe all kinds of superconducting qubits. And this is the famous 1/f noise that affects everything that I know of. And let's just make sure that we agree on what it is. So this shows some noise, some fluctuating variable in the time domain. And if we, from that, measure the spectral density, we find that the spectral density scales as 1/frequency to the power beta, where beta is on the order of 1, but not necessarily exactly 1. And so that's shown on this log-log plot here. It was first observed in vacuum tubes. It's present in carbon resistors, semiconductor devices, metal films, superconducting devices, the flood level of the River Nile, all kinds of music and everything else, all obey this wonderful 1/f spectrum. So sometimes it's very nice, but usually it's a big problem. And I'm going to be talking about some work that I did in collaboration very recently with Roger Koch and David DiVincenzo at IBM. And I'll say a few words by way of introduction. And then I'll talk a little bit about the facts of one of RF fluxnoids in squids and qubits. And then I'll present the model. And then I'll have some questions at the end. So at least in solid-state devices, people generally believe that one of RF noise originates in what's called a random telegraph signal. And so let's imagine now that you have some variable that you switch on and off between two levels at random times. And this example could be a particle in a double well that jumps backwards and forwards. And if you have the same characteristic time in both directions, one can show that the spectral density of this random telegraph signal is proportional to this time tau over 1 plus omega squared tau squared. And so the notion then is that if you have a broad distribution of these times, then the superposition of these processes, provided they are uncorrelated, will give you 1 over F noise. And the simplistic picture is this, that if you have this whole bunch of Lorentzians, and then you add them up, you'll get something that gives you 1 over F behavior. In fact, it's remarkable, you only need a quite small number to have something that looks like 1 over F. So that, I think, is the generally held origin of 1 over F noise, at least for solid-state devices. So if we focus now on superconducting devices, all known devices exhibit this. Squids, single electron transistors, charge qubits, flux qubits, phase qubits, and so on. And I think it's generally agreed that there are three different kinds of this 1 over F noise. The first is what I call charge noise. And the idea there is that you have electrons that hop between traps, either on the surface of the material or maybe on the surface of the substrate. And each time one of these hopping processes occurs, you get a fluctuation on the charge, in the charge on nearby films and junctions, and the superposition of these processes gives you 1 over F noise. The second is what I call critical current noise, and this pertains to noise in the critical current of Josephson junctions. And the notion here is that the trapping and release of electrons in tunnel barriers modify the transparency of the junction. That is to say, you freeze out a little bit of the junction for a while, and this causes both its resistance and its critical current to fluctuate. And many of us worked on this problem in the 1980s. And finally, there's the problem of flux noise. And the idea here is that you have a mechanism that actually gives you varying flux in the squid. And until the last few months, I think this was not really understood at all. But the important point I want to make is that all three kinds of noise generate decoherence in qubits and are a very significant barrier to scaling up. And I think it's very important to make that point. So now let me talk briefly about one of the flux noise in squids and qubits. And again, this is work that we did about a quarter of a century ago, when we got very interested in the sources of noise in squids, which we're using not for qubits, but for measuring devices. And what we do is we operate the squid in what's called a flux lock loop, so that you keep the flux in the squid constant, and you measure a 1 over F flux noise that is therefore a spectral density scaling as 1 over F. And what we were able to show is, by using various bias schemes, that in fact there were two separable contributions to the 1 over F noise. And the first is one that I mentioned before. This is the critical current noise, and this means you have 1 over F noise in the actual junctions. And it turns out, and I won't get into the details, that you can eliminate that with appropriate bias schemes. And the second is the idea of flux noise, and this cannot be removed by a bias current reversal. You're stuck with it. One of the remarkable facts that we'll come back to is the fact that at, say, 4 Kelvin, the flux noise square root of 1 hertz varies only by about a factor of 3 or so for a variation in squid areas that runs over several orders of magnitude. And so people began to have the feeling that this is some kind of universal process. This is a set of measurements that was made by Fred Wellstone, when he was my student, and Christian Urbina as a postdoc, where we looked at a dozen different squids at low temperatures. And this is now looking at the actual value of the flux noise at 1 hertz in microfine oil per root hertz versus temperature down to maybe 70 millikelvin. And these were devices that were made from different materials in different areas. And you can see that there's some bizarre temperature dependencies. But the thing that's remarkable is that the lowest temperatures, all of these values of the noise came within plus or minus 50% of the central value. And this is something that's been sitting there for almost 20 years at this point. There's been much more recent work on one-over-f flux noise in flux qubit, of which I think maybe some of the best was done at MEC by Yoshihara and co-workers. And I think it's immediately obvious that if you have flux noise in the loop, for example, that will enter because it modulates nu, the spinning of the energy levels, because we have a term in d nu by d phi, d phi applied. And so they measured a bunch of these qubits, and here is in fact, they turned it into a decoherence rate versus the applied flux about the degeneracy point. And what you see is that this term goes to zero at the degeneracy point, but then it increases linearly as you go away from it, and the red lines are that fit to the data. They showed very explicitly that this decoherence was not due to critical current fluctuations. And they came up with a value of something around 1 to 2 microfine oil per root hertz. I will add, but I won't go into it, that you have similar effects and comparable magnitudes in the Saclade quantronium, which is the charge phase hybrid, and also in phase qubits. This is from John Martinez and co-workers at Santa Barbara. So all of these qubits suffer from this problem. And so just to summarize the weak area dependence, I've written some numbers here. For areas that went up to as large as 10 to the fifth square microns, we saw a value of flux noise is around, say, 10 microfine oil per root hertz. Whereas the flux qubits from NEC were perhaps 3 square microns, but the noise was only an order of magnitude lower. These measurements are at millikelvin. The experiments are very heavily shielded against environmental noise. The flux noise scales very weakly with area, and this sort of really rules out the idea of a universal magnetic field noise. Because obviously, then you would have a flux noise that increased with area. It also makes the point that making radiometers is useless. This isn't going to help you. So this is the model. So the basic idea is the following. That again, let's assume that we have traps or defect sectors. And we're assuming that single electrons hop on and off these traps under thermal activation. And so this is the same starting point as with charge noise and critical current noise. But the thing that's different is the idea of spin locking. And the notion here is that we assume that the spin of the electron is locked in direction for the entire time it occupies a trap. So we assume that the direction of that spin locking varies randomly from trap to trap. So that if you now hop from one trap to the next, this will randomly change the direction of the spin and the associated magnetic moment. And so obviously the flux coupled to the qubit by an electron in a given position depends on the direction which the spin is pointed. So I think there are two issues we need to discuss. The first one is, what is the mechanism for spin locking? And notice that that locking has to persist for times at least as long as the lowest, 1 over the lowest frequency that you see in the 1 over f noise. And secondly, what is the magnitude of the one-over-f flux noise that you could imagine generating by an ensemble of these RTSs? Well, it turns out the spin locking has been known since about 1930. It was pointed out by Kramers that there's this famous degeneracy. And what it says is that if you have an odd number of fermions, let's say one with a spin half, and in a zero magnetic field, the ground state is doubly degenerate. And we all learned that in graduate quantum mechanics, and then thought, well, that's nice, and forgot about it. It's a simple property of symmetry, it turns out. So an electron with a non-zero orbital momentum, that is, say, a p state, the magnetic moment, which is L plus 2s, which is produced by the spin orbit coupling, is locked to the direction of the crystal field. Okay? And if it turns out that you have an s state with no orbital angular momentum, or if the orbital angular momentum were quenched, then you only have an angular momentum due to the electron, and that doesn't couple to the crystal field. So it's an important part of this assumption that you have an L value greater than zero, and also that the angular momentum is not quenched. Well, in 1940, there's another famous paper by Van Vleck, which led to what has become known as the Van Vleck cancellation. And what he's really saying is the same thing, in a sort of rather different viewpoint. Let's imagine, as an example, that we have a p electron, and the six states are split by a crystal field. Here's the ground state. What he showed was that the matrix elements in zero magnetic field absolutely forbid the transition between these two states. And so if the electron starts out in this state here with a given spin orientation, it will stay there forever. So the final thing is, you might say, aha, but suppose that I had second order processes, for example, Raman processes involving a photon. So you could have a process that does this. You make a transition from the ground state to the first excited state, and then subsequently you return to the other ground state. So that's a plausible scenario. Well, there's a wonderful paper by Elihu Abrams that is about to be 40 years old. Wow. And he showed that the lifetime, 50 years old, thank you, yes. Gee, that's very interesting. I just didn't know that. He showed that the lifetime for this process goes as 1 over the temperature to the power 13. And I mean, that's an amazing temperature dependence, and I actually worked through his matrix elements, and I think he's right. But to give you an idea, even at 1 Kelvin, this time is on the order of centuries. And so it will never happen. And I might also point out that he wrote this paper to explain the fact that there's no electron spin resonance in donors in silicon at low temperatures. And so in that sense, people have known forever about spin locking. It's just that none of us ever put these pieces together. So that's spin locking. And the last thing that we have to do is to figure out, well, how big a noise would this produce? So here's our model. The blue square represents the squid or the qubit loop, which of course is a superconductor. There's a hole in the middle, and then some exterior also. And so what we need to do is now assume that we couple this to some random distribution of traps. So there's our random distribution, the red dots. And the areal density we take to be n. So there are n of these per square meter. And there are three possible contributions to the flux noise. First of all, you can have a trap that's inside the loop. And when you hop from one trap to another, this can produce flux noise that will couple to the loop. We'll call this hole noise. And then you could have noise generated by traps under the loop. And these could be, for example, either in the surface of the substrate or in the surface of an oxide layer on the superconductor. And thirdly, you can also have traps outside the squid. And to make the problem finite, there's a dashed box here. And that's drawn so that noise coupled from traps outside is less than 1% of the noise coupled from a trap in the center. That's just to give an arbitrary cutoff, just to save computing time. And then finally, the way we do the computation is the following. This is a little loop which carries current and therefore represents a magnetic moment. And so what we're going to do in a minute is to calculate the mutual inductance between this little test loop and the big loop and use that as a way to determine the coupling between an electron moment on one of these traps. So first of all, we're going to do this calculation for a single spin. And so here's a side view now of the loop, these two blue lines. There is a hole, an exterior, and here's the loop. And then here is a cross-section of a loop like this that is producing a magnetic moment perpendicular to the loop. Secondly, there will be moments that are in the plane of the loop, and those can either point in this x direction, or they might point into the screen in the y direction. And so I call these in-plane moments. And each of these can, in principle, couple to the loop. And so the loop now has an area A, and we assume that we induce in it a current, I, such that the magnetic moment, AI, is equal to the Bohr magneton. And so if I vary the size of the loop, I would vary the size of the current corresponding. And so what we want to do is to find the mutual inductance between this test loop and the squid, which I call M, and that will be a function of position x, y, and also of the orientation. And then we calculate M using Fast Henry, which is a well-known program, at least for experimentalists, to calculate inductances between things. And then finally, the flux coupled to the squid loop is given by this mutual inductance times mu b divided by the area, that is to say, by M times I. And so we can then finally plot the flux in the squid loop per Bohr magneton versus position. Okay? And so here are a set of results for a single loop as we move it around. And so on the vertical axis, we have the flux induced in the squid loop versus the position. Here is zero, this is the midpoint of the loop. And then I'm increasing the distance to right or left. And we've plotted this for both in-plane moments and perpendicular moments. So the perpendicular moment, so that's with the magnetic moment perpendicular to the loop, is the solid line. And what you see is it peaks at the edges of the superconductor. It's zero in the middle of the superconductor. And you can convince yourself that has to be by symmetry. And then it has a local minimum in the middle. The dashed line shows the in-plane moment. So that's now with the magnetic moment in the plane of the squid loop. And what you see is that actually peaks at the midpoint of the superconductor. And it falls off very rapidly as you move away from the superconductor. In fact, you can easily see that if this magnetic moment were exactly in the plane of the superconducting loop, by symmetry, it wouldn't couple, because half the flux would go up and half the flux would go down. So really, you only worry about the in-plane moments when they're under the superconducting loop. OK, so now we have to do a little bit of analysis. How do we turn one spin into many spins? And then how do we turn that mean square noise into one of ref noise? So these are the two things we have to do. So for a single spin, the flux coupled into the squid loop, as I said before, is given by this expression here, which we calculate. And then you have to take into account the fact that you've got three orientations, z, x, and y. And so the mean square value of m squared is given by the sum of the orthogonal components divided by 3. And the mean square noise is then given as follows. So this is delta phi s squared. And what we did was to integrate over a triangle in one quadrant of the squid loop. And that's why there's a factor of 8 up front. So we integrate this quantity over y, and then we integrate it over x, and it scales as mu b squared. And so this is an estimate of the mean square noise. But then we have to go from there to one of the ref noise. And so we do the following. We're going to set this spectral density equal to a constant, which we have to figure out, divided by frequency. And then, to keep things finite, we introduce lower and upper cutoff frequencies, F1 and F2. And then you say, OK, the mean square flux noise is given by the integral of df over f times alpha. Obviously gives you alpha times log F2 over F1. Fortunately, that means that the value of the noise is only logarithmically sensitive to these cutoffs. But if you take some plausible numbers of 10 to the minus 4 hertz and the gigahertz, we find that the mean square flux noise of a phi 0 squared is given by this quantity here, delta phi s over phi 0 squared divided by 30f. And so the 30 comes from converting from log to base e to 10, and then the ratio of these two numbers. So that's the prediction. And what we have to do now is to figure out what n is. This is the aerial density of the defects, and this has been something that has stirred up much interest in the community. But in order to make the predicted noise fit the sorts of values you see experimentally, you need to have about 5 times 10 to the 17th defects producing noise per square meter. And so we're assuming that the surface defects are in, say, the silicon oxide on the substrate, contaminants produced by exposure to chemicals, and the atmosphere, and so on. And if you imagine you have about a 10 nanometer layer, which is probably less than you have, it means you only need to have one defect per 10 to, per 1,000 atoms. Now, you may think, well, do you really get that much, that density of defects from, say, a silicon surface? And there was a very important and much overlooked experiment that was done by Roger Koch and Bob Hamers at IBM 20 years ago. And it's amazing how none of us latched onto this and really understood the implications. But what they did was the following. They were using a scanning tunneling microscope to look at the surface of silicon. And first of all, they looked at ultra-clean silicon surfaces that had been cleaned with all the expertise of a surface scientist. And then they exposed the surface to a very low concentration of oxygen. This is maybe a part in 10 to the 10th of atmospheric concentration for 20 seconds, and then we pumped it out again. And then they scanned around with that STM. Excuse me. Looking for random telegraph signals in the STM. And what they found in typical areas was something like 8 two-level systems in a very small area. And that corresponds to an aerial density of 2 times 10 to the 17th per meter squared over a quite narrow bandwidth. And so if you assume that these RTSs are spread out over some 13 decades of frequency, what you find is that you have an aerial density of about 2 times 10 to the 18th per square meter. And remember, these were not exposed to the atmosphere for any length of time. They were given a very small whiff of oxygen for a very short time. And I think the thing that we have all grossly underestimated for decades is this enormous density of two-level systems on the surface of anything that's been exposed to the atmosphere. Well, let me just try to quickly wrap this up because I'm running out of time. So what's the bottom line of it? So assuming this value of defects on the surface, we can now take this model and we can calculate the flux noise at 1 hertz, again in units of microfinewatt per root hertz, as we vary the loop size. So we're just going to make the loop size bigger. And for this particular case, we've kept the aspect ratio constant. That is to say, the width of the strips divided by the outer dimension of the squid. And there are various plots here. First of all, the blue data are those from the perpendicular spins outside the squid. The red data here are from the perpendicular spins that are actually under or over the squid loop. And the green data are the results from the perpendicular spins in the hole. And finally, the red data show the noise generated by the in-plane spins that lie underneath the superconductor. And what you see is that, those actually dominate. If you add all these together, this gives you a total noise. And what you see is that it varies quite slowly with a dimension. That is, you go from something like 3 to 300 microns diameter, which is four orders of magnitude in area. The noise has only gone up by a factor of about 3. And so what you see is that it does give a very slow dependence of the noise on the area of the device. Now, you can ask me, well, does it fit the data? And I think I would answer, the data aren't there. That to really understand this, you'd have to make a large array of qubits or squids in the same process, on the same chip, under the same conditions, and measure them all. And that isn't going to happen in the next week or two. But I think at least there's a prediction now for what you might hope to see. Should I talk about nuclear spins for 2 minutes, or should I? Maybe if I can keep you all for another 3 minutes, let me make one more point. There are people who would argue that it's nuclear spins. And you know, there are lots of nuclear spins, and I will argue I don't think that's possible. And let me produce some simple experimental evidence that I think would say by scaling, this is not the answer. So let's look at this for a moment. Remember that the noise power, flux noise power, scales as the square of the magnetic moment times the density of spins. And there exists data in the literature where people have made squids out of both niobium and out of lead. And as I showed in an earlier plot, for all practical purposes, the noise level was the same. But now let's look at the properties of those two metals. Niobium has a density per cubic meter. You can look up. It's 100% abundant. Niobium 52, which has a magnetic moment of this much, 0.00336 floor magnetons. Lead, 207, is the only isotope with a magnetic moment. That's the number per cubic meter. It's only 22% abundant, and it has a miserable magnetic moment. And so if you were to scale these two together, you would find that the niobium noise versus the lead noise would have to be about three orders of magnitude. And they're not. The fact is they're within maybe a factor of two of each other. So I think the scaling argument, or leaving aside any theory, would say that this is not the explanation. The other thing you can say is, well, what about the substrate? Well, let's look at silicon. Silicon 29, which is the only isotope with a magnetic moment on the nucleus, is 5% abundant. It also has a miserable magnetic moment. Sapphire, on the other hand, has 100% abundance of aluminum 27. It has a magnetic moment that's 7 times bigger. And so the noise generated by sapphire substrates over that generated by silicon would have to be about 500. And it's not observed. I mean, the fact is that the noise level is essentially the same on both. So I would say that I think that for almost any model, nuclear spins as the origin of the noise are really ruled out. And the other point I'd like to make is that right now, I personally at least don't see a mechanism for generating 1/f noise from nuclear spins. I don't have a model for that. So let me try to wrap up. You can say, well, all this has raised more questions than answers. For example, what kind of defects are involved? How might one measure the density of two-level systems? Well, I think Roger Koch has shown us the kind of experiments. How might one verify the scaling of the dimensions when you make a whole bunch of devices? with a wide range of dimensions on a single process. The really interesting question is, how could you improve it? Can you get rid of this process that is responsible only for flux noise, but for charge noise, and I think critical current noise? If you want to suffer a lot, I think you could try the following, that you make a device and you cool it down and you measure the flux noise, and then you try to remove this surface contamination with an iron bombardment in situ, right, which would be not so easy to do. But in principle, you could then try to clean off the surface of the device and the substrate and see if the noise then goes down. And so I put in parentheses here, it would be A, heroic, which it would be, and second, non-scalable, which it's hard to imagine a quantum computer if you have to sort of clean off with this process. So there are other things that might be more appealing. There are a couple of sets of squids, again, this goes back 20 years, that were made at IBM, which were passivated. That is to say that they covered the device and the substrate with some other layer of material, which I think they're not willing to tell us about, which seems to have reduced the level of one over F noise. And so these values here are quite a bit lower than the canonical numbers, maybe an order of magnitude lower. So my own gut feeling is that some kind of passivation might be the way to go on this. So let me just conclude that what I've tried to show here is that we have a flux noise model that's based on the hopping of electrons between traps. And in those traps, the spins are locked in direction, but they're random from trap to trap. And the crucial underlying physics is this famous Cramer's degeneracy, which means that you never get transitions between these two states. We've also assumed, and I think this is justified from other measurements, that these traps have a broad range of energies and hence a broad range of trapping times, and those uncorrelated processes then lead to one over F noise. We've seen that the model requires a density of traps of about 5 times 10 to the 17th per square meter. And I think that this is a reasonable number for substrates or metals that have been exposed to the atmosphere. The noise amplitude increases slowly as the device dimensions are increased. And remember that that was a crucial part of experimental observation. And at least in a qualitative way, I think this model gets that right. A very interesting point is that this model itself does not discriminate between traps on the substrate and traps that might be in the oxide layer or the contaminant layer on the superconductor. And I think from this model, we have no way of discriminating between those two. I mean, one would have to do appropriate experiments. And finally, and I mean, this gives the model, I think, a certain amount of appeal, that it unifies the concepts of charge, critical current, and flux noise into the notion of trapped electrons. So I'm sorry to go over, and thank you very much for listening.
I don't remember, did you say what the temperature dependence would be if this model was correct? Or?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question. And let me just flash back a minute. We'll get there. I mean, what you can see is that the temperature dependence can be remarkable. And you could ask, why would that be? It's because you may have a non-uniform distribution of traps in energy. So that when you reduce the temperature slightly, you've obviously changed the Boltzmann factor. And so what that means is that you are looking at a different range of energies of the traps in order to contribute to the noise. And you can get any temperature dependence you like simply by speculating that you have a different distribution of energy other than one that is flat. And so I could easily fit any of those curves by saying, well, I'm going to pick a distribution that looks like this, and I'll get that curve. So I think that there's no sort of really good a priori way of doing that. There is, however, a handle on it that comes out of a model by Dutter and Horn that goes back also about 20 years. The slope of the power spectrum, the beta, can be related to the distribution of energies. And so there are sort of things that you could actually undertake to do if you were persistent, and I think someone has to be persistent on this. So what you'd have to do is to take a bunch of devices and measure the full temperature dependence and the full spectrum so that you measure the value of beta. And you might then be able to make a plausible story out of all this. But I think it will be a major undertaking. Several, maybe many theses would have to be spent on this. So I think that our model itself would never have anything to say about this, because I think you have to do this experiment.
So I was going to ask the same question, but maybe a follow-up question would be, so why then does it appear that most of the temperature dependence disappears below about 0.5 Kelvin?
Well, it may be that thermal activation is replaced by quantum tunneling, for example. You could also say, well, if I pick the right variation of energies, then I could actually compensate any temperature dependence. There's evidence from other kinds of measurements. I mean, for example, glasses. You probably know that you get these quantum processes, tunneling processes that go on at low temperatures, and so that could also be an explanation. So I think there's a lot of fascinating physics in this that I think that has been sitting there for 20, 25 years, and I'd like to think that this model will help people get motivated to go and study some of these issues.
Just a quick question. With the current control triple coupler, is the dominant source of noise flux noise, or is it shot noise and current, or is there one main source that you can
I think it's flux noise. I mean, what am I going to say? I might not put it in print, but I suspect it's flux noise. It's actually quite hard to nail down all of these things, but we've worked very hard at going through noise on the flux bias lines, for example, which would be an obvious thing. But as far as we can see, this is way below the value that it would be need to give the rates of decoherence that we see.
Bias proofing closes the critical current.
Yes. That's right. And the reason is it's a pulse. Right, it's a very short measurement. And we've looked at the variation in that pulse height from shot to shot.
More questions? Yes, Jim again.
Okay, sorry. When you showed that comparison between p-type and matrix elements,
yes.
Right? So, are you really using a weak drive pulse? Because, the probability of making the upper state transition is low? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Just
yes. Yes. I don't. No. I think it's not due to saturation.
Okay.
Wrong again.
So, is it likely that quasi-particle excitations could be a source of some noise in this system as well?
Yes, but I mean certainly the qubit experiments and these low temperature squid experiments are not too many quasi-particles left around. We've got the niobium with a TC of 9.5, and we're at maybe 70 millikelvins, so not a huge number of quasi-particles. And I think, I wouldn't want to rule out anything in this business, but I think there isn't evidence from other experiments that people have done, but there's a big contribution from the quasi-particles.
Yeah.
In the qubit system, when you're doing a readout, how stable is the temperature? So when you actually detect it, is it actually warming up at that one instant, and then you have to wait for it to cool down?
Yes.
Is that a significant temperature?
Yeah. We've made a huge study of that. In fact, there's a paper in the works somewhere. It takes about a millisecond for the experiment to cool down to something like the equilibrium value of temperature. And there's a remarkable similarity amongst the various groups about this 1 millisecond time constant. And it's simply that once you switched out to, let me go back a little bit more. I know there's a quicker way of doing this. Well, yeah. Once you're switched out to this point, you're obviously generating quite a lot of heat, because you're typically at, 400 microvolts in a microwave. And so that's enough energy to warm everything up substantially. And so what we think happens is that you generate a lot of hot quasiparticles inside the superconducting loop of the squid, and these generate noise inside the qubit itself. And you have to wait for all that to dissipate, and it takes about a millisecond. And we can, I mean, buried on in this, in here somewhere, I have a whole set of measurements where we've looked at how long you have to wait in order to come back to the equilibrium values of things like T1 and T2. So it's a big concern.
So how hot do you think it could be getting for that one?
Well, the quasiparticles probably get to maybe 200 or 300 millikelvin. They're not so hot that you see the gap reduced measurably. But in order to explain what we see, they have to get up to something like that. Of course, it doesn't mean to say the whole chip does, or even that the phonons get that hot. But the hot quasiparticles are way out of equilibrium, and you have to wait for the energy to get dumped into the phonons and then to escape through the usual Kapitza resistance into the substrate.
Other questions? Okay, so let's thank the speaker again.